It all seems to have started in October of 2016, when WikiLeaks dumped this massive batch of hacked emails. And among them were notes from John Podesta, at the time Hillary Clinton's campaign chair. In some of them, Podesta happened to mention a pizzeria in Washington, D.C., Comet Pizza. In an article for The Atlantic, Adrian LaFrance tells this story of how this idea took hold, this theory that Podesta wasn't really talking about a pizza place, that was a front for something sinister. And however it is these things shapeshift and morph, a story emerged that in the basement of Comet Pizza was a child sex trafficking ring. And that ring was run by none other than Hillary Clinton herself. Now, a lot of people believed it, a lot, including a man named Edgar Madison Welch.
Welch is this young father living in North Carolina, and he starts finding his way to these YouTube videos. He believed in what's called Pizzagate, this conspiracy theory, and the videos are claiming that there is a secret cabal of really powerful people, politicians and celebrities and CEOs working together in secret and ritualistically abusing children. And part of the core idea of these videos is that it's happening in a pizza shop in Washington, D.C.
There's children getting tortured and molested and eating.
I believe it.
I'm starting to think that it's possible that Pizzagate, Comet Pizza, isn't a myth.
Don't let somebody else's opinion...
Pizzagate is real.
...mean anything to you.
And I'm sorry if people can't accept that.
I'm starting to think that not only are our worst fears confirmed...
John and Tony Podesta's art collection...
We need to end this
I'm starting to think our worst fears weren't bad enough.
We need to end it. Now.
And so after a number of conversations with friends, you know, he's fought with his girlfriend about this. He's texted multiple friends asking them to join him on some sort of mission to confront the people who he believes are secretly committing horrible acts in a pizza shop in D.C. He decides to go it alone.
That at least stayed enough for you, for other children just like you.
So he drives hundreds of miles to Washington, brings three weapons with him, walks into this pizza shop on a weekend day that's filled with kids and their parents eating pizza.
Basically, a person walked in, kind of tall, slender, white guy.
And fires his weapon.
And all of a sudden, we saw and heard police converging.
Thankfully, no one's hurt. But he continues to sort of walk through the pizza shop as people have fled, looking for this thing that he's convinced is there, and it's not. And he realizes it's not, sets down his weapons, goes outside, the police are already there, and cooperates with police. Eventually, he's convicted and sent to federal prison for several years.
Pizza gunman told a packed courtroom he's sorry for terrorizing customers and families when he walked into a crowded restaurant and eventually fired his loaded AR-15 assault rifle.
I've been interested in and writing about conspiracy theories broadly for a while now, but Pizzagate, as it became known, then fed into this newer conspiracy theory that borrowed heavily from Pizzagate, known as QAnon. The impulse may be, this is madness. We shouldn't even engage with it because it's dangerous. And you may fear legitimizing it by treating it seriously. But the truth is that lots of people believe in these conspiracy theories. And it's dangerous not just because it might lead someone to bring a gun into a pizza shop, but because it represents a mass rejection of reason and an erosion of our shared reality. It poses a real and present threat and demands journalistic attention.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the cover article for the latest issue of The Atlantic magazine, Adrian LaFrance explores QAnon and how conspiracy theories in general shape history. These ideas may seem crazy, but she says they're not inconsequential. LaFrance is joining us today to talk about QAnon, which she first learned about a few years ago.
It first appeared on the internet in 2017, and it started to bubble up. Certainly people started covering the presence of QAnon supporters at Trump rallies. And so that was sort of a line of coverage I was aware of. I would see sort of hashtags on Twitter. I had a passing awareness of it. And then really about a year ago, it seemed like, you know, this thing that people have been treating as just a fringe kind of internet conspiracy seems to be gaining steam. And, you know, the president has retweeted various QAnon figures, and several people running for Congress espoused Q beliefs. And there was this mainstreamification happening that was palpable. And it just seemed like, you know, having watched people dismiss birtherism and then birtherism leading directly to the election of Donald Trump, and even Gamergate, another internet sort of something that people said was just constrained to the internet and didn't have an effect on the real world. These movements had cropped up recently, and it seemed like it was time to really seriously look at Q and what it was doing to people.
It's interesting you write that many people were reluctant to speak with you about QAnon as you started to dig in, which says what? There's a kind of something pretty ferocious and a little disturbing about the people who run in these circles, I guess.
Well, yeah, it's really interesting because certainly since this story was published in recent days, my internet life has been very colorful. I've gotten some scary emails, and my Twitter mentions are full of all kinds of interesting commentary. But the people I met in person who described themselves as true believers of QAnon were perfectly nice. And so there is this difference between individuals who believe it and take it seriously and earnestly, and then this sort of online mob that sort of just descends on anyone who dares question Q.
We'll get to one of those characters, one of those people that you met here in a moment, because it's part of the story. But just the basics here. Who is QAnon, or what is QAnon? Like, just give us a very basic sense of what we're talking. Those who are maybe unfamiliar with the kind of elemental parts of all of this.
Right. So it is a bit complicated. I'll try to keep it simple.
Okay.
And you'll notice it does draw heavily from Pizzagate. So
yeah.
The belief system looks basically like this. It's this idea that Q, this unknown anonymous internet poster, is in the intelligence community or a military insider with proof that corrupt world leaders are secretly torturing children all over the world, and that they're working with the quote unquote deep state, and that Donald Trump is fighting against them. And so the idea further is, you know, this Q figure, this anonymous person in real time is posting clues that they call Q drops on message boards online. And Q's followers feel that it's their job to decipher them and interpret them, and that they're part of the force for good fighting this secret cabal.
I want to ask you about the how it is. One of the things you talk about is that it's much more, you say in your article, than a loose collection of conspiracy-minded chat room inhabitants. It's bigger than that, in the sense that it's a movement, I think, is how you describe it. Talk about what's significant about that part of this.
Well, so one of the things that I was setting out to understand through my reporting was who would actually believe this. Just, it was, you know, predictions that Q had made were demonstrably false. The entire thing was patently absurd. So who is believing this, and why? And so the more I dug into this, the more it really was revealed to me that this is more than sort of fan fiction or a game that people are playing online, or just, you know, there's this participatory nature, because Q is someone who's posting, you know, if not every day, regularly. And so people can go and check and see if there's something new. And so it's different than, say, someone who might say, well, you know, the moon landing was faked. That's a distinct point in the past. It's not unfolding in real time. And so that's one thing that's different. But the thing that made me realize that it's even bigger than that is just talking to people who are Q followers and getting a sense of the sort of serenity and community that they felt they were gaining. And they really were seeing Q as this spiritual figure, and that they really, really believed. And that was something that I didn't anticipate before I did my reporting.
The religious part is interesting, isn't it? The God part. That seems a key element in all of this.
Right. It's this deep faith that people have that, you know, I found myself trying to ask people for specifics or question, you know, like, well, Q said this, but that's demonstrably false. Why do you still believe? And people were drawing on the same language that you hear from folks talking about their religious beliefs. So there was just this really, you know, clear sense of faith and spirituality woven throughout, plus this preoccupation with the end times, which also has a religious dimension.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned one of the first posts that comes from Q is this prediction that the arrest of Hillary Clinton is imminent. That's going to be coming soon. And when it doesn't play out, it doesn't really hurt the reputation of Q. You mentioned that QAnon is pretty good at brushing aside the inconsistencies or the contradictions. In fact, you say there's no form of argument that really can prevail against QAnon at this point.
Right. And people will say, well, anything that Q predicts and gets wrong, that's actually a clue. And they even say, like, if Q spells something wrong, that's a clue. So there is an explanation for all of it, and none of it makes sense.
The lingo is interesting. You mentioned the tone is kind of cliche in some way, what you hear, right?
There's a lot of, like, this is where it feels like fan fiction. There's a lot of, like, you know, all the truth will eventually be revealed and follow the money. And just, there's the language of almost like a badly written spy novel.
Adrian, talk a little bit about where Donald Trump fits in this story. You mentioned that he retweets QAnon figures, but what are the believers in QAnon? What does this group believe about the role of Donald Trump beyond the fact that he's trying to hold back this evil that's coming?
This is interesting because I'll often see references to QAnon as a far right conspiracy, and that's not quite it, actually. It's really a pro-Trump conspiracy theory. And so I haven't found, I mean, the Trump figures as a really prominent role in the Q story because he is the savior. And people, it's almost like one of the people I talked to when I was reporting, the way they described it was Q offers a moral justification for the Trump presidency that doesn't otherwise exist. And so when a Christian person, for example, might look at the Trump presidency and be troubled by his record of infidelity and how frequently he lies. And the idea is that Q gives this much larger framework to say, look, he has flaws, but this much bigger battle between good and evil is playing out and Trump is on the right side. And so that's sort of the narrative structure in which Trump's position in this conspiracy theory exists, but it's definitely a pro-Trump conspiracy theory.
So, all right, now, so fold in the coronavirus pandemic in with the Trump part, because that some of the speculation related to all of that is equally intriguing.
If you're a conspiracy theorist preoccupied with the apocalypse, a pandemic is a validating world event to experience, right? And so it really didn't take long for the coronavirus to factor prominently into the Q narrative. Although it's interesting because it seems as though Q really followed Trump's lead. So if you look back to the early days of the pandemic, when Trump was really downplaying it and saying, you know, falsely comparing it to the flu in terms of severity, Q was really not going there yet. It wasn't until right before it really reached official, you know, WHO designated pandemic, global pandemic status that Q started really engaging with the pandemic in the Q drops or the clues that he posts online. And I say he because many people refer to Q as a him, but we don't know the identity of the person or people. And so since then, the coronavirus has factored prominently. I mean, it spawned, like many things in the QAnon universe, this whole other sort of spiral of conspiracy theories within Q. So people claiming that it's deliberately unleashed upon the population as a form of population control by the quote unquote deep state. Some of your listeners have probably heard of Plandemic, which was this viral video that sort of ricocheted around the internet recently and draws heavily from QAnon themes. And so it's sort of just in a time of global chaos and misinformation, Q fits right in. And so it makes perfect sense that QAnon would suddenly sort of be cropping up around all of the misinformation related to the pandemic.
Tell the story about the theory that comes from Donald Trump's decision to wear a yellow tie to an event.
So this was one that people picked up on in Q circles and then sort of was replicated and remixed and appeared in all sorts of Facebook groups and other corners of the internet where you'll find Q folks. And it was this, someone shared a map of maritime flags and said that yellow represented sort of an all clear. And the fact that Trump then wore a yellow tie to a press briefing was proof that the coronavirus didn't really present a threat. So this is the level of, you know, trying to draw a signal from the noise. It's a good representative example of the lengths they're going to draw connections between things that aren't actually connected.
I just wanted to mention one more, and this came, I think, before the coronavirus pandemic. This was, I think, in October of 2017. And Donald Trump, I think it was in a press conference or something, but he makes a reference to the calm before the storm. And
right.
it was a weird moment, too, because he didn't really – reporters were like, well, what do you mean, Mr. President? And he didn't say. He said, well, something is coming, and – maybe it was a reference to what was going to happen in Iran, or it wasn't really clear, but the people with QAnon just ate that up.
Well, right. So it was a really weird moment anyway, because as you point out, tension with Iran, this was October of 2017, was high. And, you know, he was at a photo op with military leaders, and sort of the context was suggestive that this was a reference to some military action. And so it created a big stir. And then 3 weeks later is when QAnon first posts ever. And that becomes one of the first sort of taglines of the entire movement, this idea of a calm before the storm and the moment that we're in being sort of right before, you know, the idea being that Trump will take down this evil cabal and the storm being the thing that leads to this great, great awakening that's promised to Q followers.
It's Adrienne LaFrance. She's executive editor of The Atlantic. Her piece, The Prophecies of Q, is the cover story in the latest edition of the magazine. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Station Insider is KUER's weekly email digest. We'll bring you the most important news stories of the week, information about online events and services during the coronavirus situation, and of course, sneak peeks at what's happening at the station. Check out our other regular dispatches too, including the Radio West newsletter. To sign up for these weekly updates, just go to KUER.org/newsletters.
QAnon is the people that believe in what Trump's trying to do to change our country.
It's a movement, man. It's the shift. I can feel it coming. Some call it the Great Awakening.
Where we go one, we go all.
We are Q.
We are Q.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. On a December afternoon in 2016, a mostly mild-mannered man named Edgar Madison Welch took an assault rifle into a Washington, D.C. pizza joint and fired three times. And why? Welch had become obsessed with a person or a movement on the internet known as QAnon. And one of the ideas floated by QAnon was that there in the basement of the pizza place was a child trafficking ring run by Hillary Clinton. The Atlantic editor Adrienne LaFrance is with us today. She has a cover article in the magazine that explores QAnon and the role of conspiracy theories in shaping history. You covered the early days of the birther controversy when Donald Trump was floating this idea that Barack Obama had not been born in the United States. You were in Hawaii then as a reporter. And one of the questions that you asked yourselves, you say in your newsroom there, was, should we even be covering this? Would you talk a little bit about those conversations that you were having? Because that is an important question. Like, look, let's not even spend time with this. It's such nonsense. But it also leads to a theme in your article, which is, it's easy to dismiss this, but it may be more consequential than we're thinking.
When I decided to do this story, I was sort of interested in Q for a while, and I had a version of that same sort of thought pattern in my head as I did during the birtherism sideshow, which was, you have this impulse to say, maybe if we ignore it, it will go away.
Yeah.
But that's not a journalistic posture. It's sort of a optimistic posture, perhaps. But the truth is, in the newsroom, I worked at a place called Honolulu Civil Beat. I was a city hall reporter, and Hawaii, doesn't often make national news, and all of a sudden, people were just fascinated in Trump's obsession with the State Department of Health. And it became this whole question of how much do we cover it? And I think it's less, do you cover it at all? Because certainly it was worth covering. But how do you give people the proper frame so they understand what's happening? Like, yeah. Is there in fact a real question about the birthplace of the president of the United States? No, there wasn't. And I think some people did a good job of calling that out early, but I think President Trump has had, for his entire career in public, he's just a masterful manipulator of people's attention. He knows how to draw an emotional response. And that's what happened with birtherism. And so similarly, even with Q, I think he gets right up to the edge of plausible deniability in terms of showing support for this group while still sort of claiming not to know what it is. He'll retweet a Q account and say, I don't know what this is, but it looks good, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so when I was thinking about setting out to report this story, I thought a lot about how I think we did, as journalists, have an obligation to go directly at birtherism for what it was. And so I was thinking about that as I set out to report this one, too.
We also mentioned just dismissing some of these ideas has led to, and this is the term you use, it's such dismissal has begun to require willful blindness.
So again, you can say that this is absurd and no one should believe it, but the fact is people are believing it. And so there's the question of how do you actually help people find good information? So for the people who believe in this stuff, I hope that some of them have read this piece and reconsidered, but it's also to give those of us who don't believe but may have people in our lives who believe in it the right framework for talking about it. So it's about, reclaiming a shared reality that we can all inhabit.
How many are there out there, QAnon believers, as far as you can tell?
It's a great question, and I just don't know. It's really hard to quantify, not least of all because they're so rarely, people will pop up at Trump rallies or you'll see a banner on the side of the road or something, but it's largely an online movement, and you don't know how many people. Even if you could count, some sort of like blunt metric, like the number of retweets or something, which would be imperfect in and of itself, you wouldn't know who truly believes, who's a bot, who's politically motivated, who's just, participating for, who knows why, but doesn't really believe. So it's I don't know how to answer the question of how many, other than to say that it's clear it's growing. If you just look at the way that this messaging has spread and the growth of huge accounts devoted to Q on major social platforms. Mm.
I want to come to something that you write in the piece where that you say that this group harnesses paranoia to fervent hope and a deep sense of belonging, which gets us to this bigger idea that the end times, religious faith is deeply connected to this. And you describe it as possibly the birth of a new religion.
The formation of community around this conspiracy theory was always something that really interested me. And it was clear that people weren't just drawing faith or sort of spiritual satisfaction from Q, which is evident, or borrowing from the language of other religions, which is also evident, but that they found sort of communion with one another and, you know, that they're coming together to interpret this text, these Q drops that they see as sort of holy writ. And so I started to look at it as a formation of community through a religious lens, and really led me to the question of like, well, we don't actually know yet what it looks like for a religion to be born on the internet. And surely it only makes sense that it would happen eventually, like the way we form community now because of the internet is geographically disaggregated. So why wouldn't religions form that way as well? And so just taking into consideration the level of sort of deep faith in Q, the borrowing of ideas from other religions, and just this sense of spiritual satisfaction that the true believers are getting, it became really clear to me that it's not just a conspiracy theory, but arguably a form of or a forming religion.
You say that Seventh-day Adventists and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, they're religious movements indigenous to this country. You wouldn't be surprised if QAnon becomes another one. It'll be interesting to see what form that takes and what it looks like and how they worship and what the rituals are.
Right. And it's worth noting, too, that even one of the most influential sort of Q influencers, someone who has a huge following on YouTube and Twitter, is, registered his company as a church, and sees his view as, or his role in this movement as pastoral. Mm. And so some of the leaders within this community already are actively religious.
Final question. You say in the piece, we're likely closer to the beginning of this story than the end.
Right. So, I mean, again, this goes back to this question of, it seemed like an internet conspiracy theory that bubbled up and would stay on the margins and would fizzle out. But all it's done in nearly 3 years now is grown. And even if Trump weren't to be reelected, or perhaps especially if he weren't, I don't think that this group would abandon its worldview. I mean, it's tapped into something that people already possessed. And that came up again and again when I talked to people, that when they heard about Q, it clicked because they already felt the way that this movement espoused beliefs they already had. And so I think we will see it evolve, but I don't think it's going to go anywhere.
Adrienne LaFrance, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
That's Adrienne LaFrance. She's executive editor at The Atlantic. Her piece, The Prophecies of Q, is the cover story in the latest issue. You can find a link to the story on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Radio helps you stay informed, entertained, and connected with your community, and so does your smart speaker, because your smart speaker is also a radio. Just ask your smart speaker to play NPR and stay connected at home. Never miss a minute.
Stay connected to your community with NPR Utah. Tell your smart speaker, play KUER. To learn more about listening with your smart speaker, go to KUER.org/smartspeaker.
We don't exactly know who Q is, okay?
It's not a conspiracy, it's fact.
They're on the inside, they're the good guys.
Mount up. Digital warriors, mount up.
It involves the whole Space Force.
Physical warriors, mount up.
Alien life.
Mount up.
Pedophiles.
For where we go one, we go all.
It just, I don't think he's lying to us. Lying to us.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about conspiracy theories, in particular, a movement known as QAnon. In Adrienne LaFrance's reporting, she talked with Professor Joseph Uzinski at the University of Miami. Now, his specialty is conspiracy theories, and the professor uses public opinion surveys to get a more accurate sense of how these paranoid fantasies really fit in American culture. He told LaFrance that conspiracy thinking rises and falls along with a cycle of populism, that there's a connection there. He said many of the people most prone to believing conspiracy theories see themselves as victim warriors fighting against corrupt and powerful forces. We asked Joseph Uzinski to join us. He said QAnon has the elements of a lot of other conspiracy thinking, but there are things here that are different, that make it bigger than just a theory, more like a movement.
QAnon has characteristics that many other conspiracy theories don't, in that it has a sense of group belonging. So they have a catchphrase, where we go one, we go all. They refer to themselves as patriots. They think of themselves as a nonviolent research community. So they see themselves as a collective, and there's a strong sense of group belonging there. And you don't necessarily have that with other conspiracy theories.
One of the things Adrienne LaFrance mentions, she describes the QAnon belief system as Q being this intelligence or military insider with proof that corrupt world leaders are torturing children and that Donald Trump is working to thwart all of this. It's a cabal of powerful elites. That seems like a trope. That seems fairly typical in these theories.
Yeah, so that's the basic of QAnon, but that's been around in all sorts of different theories forever, seemingly. And a lot of QAnon is largely just the plot of Oliver Stone's JFK.
Right.
So in that movie, you had a deep state full of pedophiles, and you know they're sort of associated with evil and you know some dark magical looking stuff, and they were out to you know do something bad to the president. This is just that. It's almost the same thing. And many of the component parts of QAnon have been around for a long time. Yeah. Whether it's you know there's secret cabals of child snatchers or child molesters or people eating babies or sucking magical powers out of babies, or the idea that there's simply a deep state, or that you know there are things going on beyond our control that are in plain sight but essentially hidden from us. I mean, none of these ideas are particularly new.
Is it fair to say it's a like a framework almost, and you can put whatever thing is happening at the moment onto this framework? So right now it's a pandemic, and other times it's the assassination of a president or whatever it is. Does it work that way in some ways?
Sure, and all conspiracy theories do that. You can adapt any theory you want to any circumstance you want. And in that sense, conspiracy theories are like fan fiction. People can make up anyone, anytime, of any variety they want to serve any need they have. So it's not like there's one official version or two official versions. There's infinite numbers of conspiracy theories out there that people can make up. And within the Q community, if you follow their discussions on Twitter, you'll find there's all sorts of different beliefs that people have attached to this. Some of them involve time travelers intervening in American politics. Others suggest that Hillary Clinton's going to be killed soon, but other people think she's already been killed and has been replaced by a robot. But then other people disagree and think she's been replaced by a body double. But then someone else is concerned, what do we do with the body double? Should they be executed too? So there's all sorts of stuff going on within this community, and they're largely given free rein to make up whatever they want, because most of the information they get from Q is just garbled nonsense anyway.
Yeah. What's the common characteristic for someone to believe one or start thinking that there might be something to it? Is it a lack of trust in leadership and government? Is it just a sense of anxiety in general? Are there characteristics here?
Well, for QAnon, there's probably a set of characteristics. And that is, these people largely tend to be anti-establishment folks. That's not that they see the world as a battle between right and left, but as a battle between us and a corrupt establishment. And that's why, you know, QAnon followers aren't, you know, really one political party or the other, even though a lot of people think they are. It's really even between Democrats and Republicans. And if you look at who they accuse of different things, I mean, they think Tom Hanks, Barack Obama, George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush are all in on it. So they, you know, everybody either in Hollywood and Washington are all part of this cabal.
Yeah.
But if it's other conspiracy theories, essentially that question boils down to something much more general, and that is, why do people believe anything? And the answer is, for a whole lot of reasons.
Yeah. Well, I want to get into some of the research that you've done on conspiracy theories that you've written about recently and have been writing about for some time. You mentioned how your take on conspiracy theories bothers a lot of people, people on a lot of different sides, the believers in those theories, but also, as you mentioned, political partisans. Explain what you mean there, that what you're saying is one side always believes it's the other side who believes the crazy stuff.
Yeah, I mean, what I find in my survey research is that both Republicans and Democrats are about equally likely, in terms of their underlying worldview, to buy into specific conspiracy theories. Now, they will buy into different conspiracy theories, right? Like each side will buy into ones that will implicate the other side in conspiring. But they will tend to, over time, adopt, you know, the same amount of conspiracy theories. And, you know, neither side likes thinking that, you know, They're only as rational as the other side, you know, because they prefer to think of themselves as the rational one, and the other side is the conspiracy goat. But this is particularly upsetting to people on the political left, who just can't fathom the idea that the right isn't a bunch of conspiracy kooks, and they try to deal with this finding in one of several ways. And one way is to say, well, yeah, we have conspiracy theories on the left, but it's just the people on the fringe. And that's not true. And then they say, well, we have conspiracy theories, but, you know, the leaders in our party, you know, things like that, never push conspiracy theories, or our left-wing media never pushes conspiracy theories. And that's not true either. Mm-hmm. So there's this idea, and it's longstanding. I mean, it goes back as far as Richard Hofstadter, when he did studies in the 1950s and 60s of, you know, mostly what he called right-wing extremist groups, you know, the John Birch Society and whatnot. And he saw this strain of conspiratorial thought running through some of these groups. So people thought, oh, it must be conservatives. But there's no real reason to think why conservatism would be latched to conspiracy thinking in any meaningful way, any more than liberalism would be.
Let me push back on that, or at least ask something that did come up to me when I read about that point that you make in your book. You say there's no reason to believe that a conspiracy thinking is more that you see more of it in the Republican Party than the Democratic Party, or conservatives or liberals. But I did wonder, is it not true that conservatives are more skeptical of science, say, or more inclined to have religious people in their groups, and that religious people have more ideas about Armageddon or the struggle between good and evil or magical thinking? I guess what I'm asking, is there a qualitative difference between the right and the left? And I'm sure you probably get this question all the time, but it does seem different that the things that they believe in, and that's worth saying. I mean, it's one thing to say Bernie Sanders, as you point out in your book, believes that the system is rigged for the 1%. But that's one thing. It seems like there's a qualitative difference between that and someone who believes Hillary Clinton helped run a child sex ring out of the basement of a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. Does that make sense?
Well, there's a lot there. So if people are coming to ideas because of their religion, then that's their religion that's doing the driving there, not the being a member of the Republican Party or being conservative. In terms of magical thinking, I find a lot of people on, you know, hanging out in crystal shops who aren't Republicans. So, you know, I don't measure those things myself. You know, the magical thinking, there's other scholars who do that. I keep my conclusions to what I measure, and that's conspiracy thinking. In repeated surveys, I find over and over again, it's largely the same. If you want to say there's a qualitative difference between, one particular theory you pick out, pushed by Bernie Sanders, and one very fringe theory, QAnon, I mean, you have to recognize, again, that QAnon is believed about equally between right and left, even though a lot of people don't want to accept that, first of all. And then second of all, I mean, the 1% theory is widely held and formed the basis of a major campaign twice for the DNC. Whereas, we don't really have a QAnon forward presidential candidate. I mean, the best you could say there would be Trump, who sort of hangs around with Q positive people, but he hasn't made, baby eating a major part of his campaign. This isn't to absolve Trump or Republicans of anything that they do, but it's more to say, this is more of a human condition, and attempts to say, well, it's these people or those people sort of miss the point.
Yeah. Seems like that's a theme in the book. It's where you come back to at the end of your books to say this is a human condition. This is human nature. We're inclined to think some of these things.
Yeah, I mean, it's been around long before the Democratic or Republican parties existed, right? So it's not driven by one of the two. And, I mean, if anything, I mean, it's a point that I push a lot, is that there are a lot of Democrats who've just bought this idea that they're the rational ones. And no, they fall victim to their anti-science beliefs from time to time, and their paranormal and supernatural beliefs from time to time, albeit different ones.
I think the idea that you talk about a lot is the importance of these things being supported by polling data or evidence. Because you say for journalists, it's always fashionable to report a conspiracy panic. But you say the reports are based on little more than feelings often. It's just these anecdotal impressions. Is that what you're getting at there?
Yeah. So we went back in time through newspapers, and we looked at all the instances in which journalists were saying, we're in the golden age of conspiracy, or now we've become the most conspiratorial, or this is the year. And we find that that's reported every year. So it can't always be true, right? And a lot of the things they say, just, it's clear it's not backed up by any sort of data or evidence.
Based on what you are polling about, what's the characteristic? What are the characteristics of the poll of the theories that you're seeing these days? Like, what are people thinking about these days? And this seems a little bit like interpreting dreams in some ways. Like, where did that come from, and how did they get that? But what do you make of what you're seeing, if you can say anything about that?
So surveys are good at some things and not good at others. So I don't always know if someone, they may agree with a conspiracy theory when I give it to them and ask them if they agree or disagree, but it may not be very high on their thought process before I showed it to them. And it may not even be something they really thought of, but it just may ring true at that particular moment when they're answering a survey. And the other issue is, too, I have no way to know, even if they do deeply care about it, how they got to it, if they made it up themselves, if they heard it from a family member or saw it online or from a political leader. It's tough to know. So it's not, it's hard to find out those sorts of things, but what we find is that the more conspiracy theories we ask about on any given poll, the fewer and fewer people are going to believe in none. So the last poll I ran was in mid-March. We asked about 22 conspiracy theories, and I think 91% of people agreed with at least one.
Were there any that surprised you that there are people that who believed these things? I guess the one thing is, like, is the Earth flat? Stuff like that, I guess. What did anything surprise you in those 22 that there's no way anyone's going to believe this particular thing?
So some surprise me and disappoint me a little bit. Yeah. So we asked if the dangers of 5G cell phone technology are being covered up, and we got 26% agreeing. Wow. 17% believe that school shootings, like those that happened at Parkland in Florida here and Sandy Hook, are false flags meant to take our guns. Let's see. We asked if the number of Jewish people killed in the Holocaust has been exaggerated for political purposes, 15%.
Wow.
So about 1 in 7 people buy into that. So some of these you can look at and be like, oh, that's funny or whatever. But some it's almost upsetting to see the number of people buying in, because some of the beliefs are fairly, you know, either offensive on their own or potentially indicative of something much worse lying underneath.
Adrienne LaFrance mentions in her article that it's tempting to dismiss these as inconsequential, but we should take them seriously. And it seems like that's where you are, that we need to take this, the idea where they come from and their potential, I suppose, seriously.
Sure. So I recently pulled in a lot of conspiracy theories. Some have high numbers, some have lower numbers. Am I concerned that 1 in 3 Americans think that the government is covering up alien landings? I think it's really high number. Yeah. But I'm not concerned about what these alien believers are going to do tomorrow. But when 1 in 3 Americans think that the effects of COVID-19 are being exaggerated, mm-hmm. I am concerned about that, because that's correlated with people not taking social distancing seriously. You know, not frequently washing their hands or wearing masks and whatnot. And that can lead to, you know, disease spread. So it has a direct consequence. Or vaccine conspiracy theories leading people to not get vaccinated and either spread diseases that we thought were once cured, like measles, or potentially allow the further spread of COVID-19 once a vaccine is developed. So there, you know, depending on the theory, I mean, there could be serious consequences. You just have to remember that conspiracy theory is a big bucket mm-hmm. of ideas. So you should expect some will be more dangerous or even beneficial than others.
Back to Adrienne LaFrance's piece again, forgive me. She mentions that QAnon, and this is something you mentioned earlier too, QAnon is different because of the sort of religious faith component, maybe. One of the things she says is it's not just a conspiracy theory, but possibly, she mentions, the birth of a new religion. Do you think that this idea, as you said before, the kind of unique feature of it, that there is a collective who believe these kinds of things, who share a value system together, is there something to the idea that this could be something akin to a religious movement here?
Sure. It all depends how you define religion, and if yeah. you're talking about religious in the sense of the content of the beliefs or in how the people, express and interact with those beliefs. In sense of it being a religion, I mean, it has a strong sense of right and wrong, good and evil, and who the good and evil actors are. They have a sense of a future utopia coming when the Great Awakening happens and the satanic deep state is thwarted and they're all summarily hung for their crimes. It'll be a great day and, you know, we'll be free from the evil and all our diseases will be cured. And we might even be able to fly, according to some people. So there are some beliefs that do sound very religious and have a lot of characteristic ideas that are common in other religions. But in terms of the reasoning, it's also religious in the sense that, you know, it's tough to argue with this, right? It's a whole belief system with a lot of different moving parts. And even if you sort of try to refute one part of it, there's still the whole system that is still going to be there. And largely this is, the set of beliefs is it's hard to refute, and it's been set up that way. So it can never be proven wrong, right? And a lot of religions have that same exact quality too. So people are holding it very stridently. It's something that gives their lives meaning and value, a sense of belonging. And so in that sense, yeah, there is religious qualities to it.
Professor, let me ask you this finally. As we were saying earlier, you mentioned in your book, conspiracy theories are just a part of the human condition. And you say we have to live with these theories, but also the people who believe with them. You know, we go to family reunions and Thanksgiving dinners with them. And this is what you write in your book. You say the only way to do this, that is to live with these people, you know, get along and those sorts of things, is to have compassion, you say, and tolerance for others, and to hold our own beliefs to high standards. Would you say something about that finally?
So it's very easy for someone to attack somebody else's conspiracy theory. It's much more difficult to take an inventory of our own and go through and say, you know, which of my beliefs are warranted and unwarranted. You know, and often when we talk about, you know, pushing back against conspiracy theories or banning conspiracy theories or censoring them, we're talking about the other person's conspiracy theories. They always want to ban the other guy's theory, but never our own. And I think we have to realize that this is part of the human condition. It's not part of another human's condition. It's something that affects all of us from time to time. And we need to guard our beliefs very carefully. And so both in how we interact with our own belief systems and how we interact with other people. And I say, you know, we are related to conspiracy theorists. You know, we probably hold one or a few of these beliefs ourselves. And the only way to treat people is with empathy and compassion, because they probably came to their conspiracy belief the same way you probably came to yours.
Joseph Uzinski, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
That's Joseph Uzinski. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Miami, where he studies public opinion, mass media, and conspiracy theories. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.